with the topic of leadership and some leadership principles. And then Pastor Nan is in the rusty wheel, and he's dealing with the topic of temptation and stuff like that. His is going to be really good, so if you want to go to that one, go ahead and jump up, and you can head over there. He's a great guy. So, okay. So we have who we're supposed to have. And okay, as we come to this morning in dealing with this topic of leadership, that it we're gonna look at this in from a perspective of not as much of a okay, what are all of the exegetical studies on leadership in the Bible? We're not going to do that this morning. We're going to look at some more broad principles and then look at some really practical stuff. So this session is going to have a real practical flavor to it. And there's lots of resources where you can do those deep exegetical studies. And those studies are very important in dealing with leadership. So we're not saying don't do those. I'm just letting you know kind of up front what this one is and how we're going about it. And what I'm wanting to do is I'm wanting to share with you some of the things that I learned that really, really impacted me in my leadership. And when I was first made aware of this, it was when I had heard, you know, I grew up, my dad teaches on leadership, and I've heard all kinds of things on leadership, and I went to college and to seminary, and, you know, all the things about being a pastor and being a leader, and then I started looking at, after seminary, going to a church, and my pastor, Mike Sproul, he's a chaplain, and he was Air Force, and now he's Air Guard, and he's now in charge of all the chaplains in the Air Guard, and so he's stationed in D.C. God's given us a really neat guy in charge of the chaplains back there in Washington, D.C. But when I was interviewing for a position with him and talking with him, you know, on philosophy, he started throwing out some leadership concepts to me, and I started hearing some of these concepts. And then I took a class on leadership, and it was taught by a guy who was former Air Force, and he taught leadership at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And as he was going through it, we did this little study about leadership. And one of the assignments that we had to do is we had to make a list of all of the people that we were leading within our organization. And then we had to, in that list, we had to write down how we were leading them. And then we had to do this analysis of where they were, and then had to write down how we should be leading them. And I think I had a list of about 13 or 15 people on my list. And what I discovered at the end of that exercise is that I was leading three of them correctly. And the rest of them, I was leading wrong. And the reason that that had happened in my life, I had gotten into my head that leaders do certain things. And so I was treating everybody the same, and that it was really beginning to limit my leadership in what I was doing with what God had called me to do. And so that whole experience in that class, I mean, just opened my eyes up to how I wasn't as effective as what I thought I was, and that, man, there's some work and just practical work involved in leadership if we are going to lead well. And so the things that we're going to look at, I really believe that they are able to cross from the home leading as my role as father, my role as a husband, and leading in a work environment where I have a responsibility and people that I'm working with, and leadership within the local church that God has placed me in, that really these principles have that ability to be able to work across the spectrum in how we're doing it. What I want us to start off with, though, is for us to do a little bit of a brainstorm together, okay? And we're going to do a little bit of a brainstorm, and I want us to talk about, to think through the leadership of Christ, OK? okay? And I want you to think about some of the different people that Jesus led and how did he lead them, okay? Does that make sense? So so as we're doing this brainstorm, give the person, and then how did Jesus lead this person, okay? So example of this would be when we think of the woman at the well, okay? John chapter 5, is that we have the woman at the well, and what was the approach that Jesus had in his interaction and in his leadership in dealing with her? What was that? Okay, he was honest. Yeah, he didn't kind of run from the issues in her life, did he? Okay, good. What else?
He asked open-ended questions.
Okay, yeah, he asked some questions. And who did he ask even more questions with? John chapter 3 with Nicodemus, right? Because that was my first thing that I went to, and I'm like, oh, I'm going to need to be able to support this when I say this about the woman at the well. And then I went and read the woman at the well. And he doesn't ask as many questions there. He actually, in John chapter 3, with Nicodemus, he asks more questions in dealing with that. So when we look at Nicodemus, okay, so I don't have to spell Nicodemus, we'll call him Nick, is that he asks these questions. Here he was very straightforward, right? And in that straightforwardness, how was he straightforward? Was it a like, you're in sin, lady, and you need to deal with your sin? How did he deal with it? Okay, is matter of factly?
He
used her experiences. And there was a gentleness about it, right? Mm-hmm. That there is this gentle confrontation of her sin and what was going on in her life. Whereas when we look at Nicodemus, with Nicodemus, what does he go to with Nicodemus? Okay, with what he knows. What was that?
Tries
to get him to evaluate himself. What else does he do? Okay, he points in his ignorance in dealing with what?
The
scriptures, right? With Nicodemus, here we get a very much a theological response by Christ, and that he goes back to Moses and the serpent in the wilderness and him understanding these things that are going on, and there's this really theological discussion as he's asking questions and getting Nicodemus to realize where he is in his relationship. Okay, so let's give some more examples of a person and what was Christ's approach in working with that person. Can you think of some others?
Rich young
ruler. Okay, and how did he work with them? Okay, so how would you describe his interaction with them, though? What was that? Yeah, was he more confrontational here? He was kind of straightforward in this confrontation of what did he very quickly bring out about the rich young ruler? Yeah. Yeah, that he was confronting this value of, okay, wait a second, maybe you have not followed all of the law, because are you willing to sell everything? Are you willing to give up everything? Okay, good. Let's give another example. Yeah.
In my reading this morning, Luke 24, the two on the road to Emmaus, so they didn't recognize it was Jesus at first, and they were expecting a physical restitution of all things in Israel. And he said, you fools, slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have said, and over some time before he leaves, then he opens their understanding. So I took from that how patient Jesus was of others in their ignorance. And before that, Peter went in astonished at what he saw in the empty tomb and others, and he was very patient and waiting for the right time to expound truth.
Good, good. Can we go to Peter next? Let's talk about Peter, okay? How did Christ interact with Peter? Huh?
Which time?
Yeah, and a very important question, right? Yeah. Which time? So what were some of the different ways that that Christ interacted with Peter?
In John 21, when Peter jumped out of the boat and let the other six to haul in, he wasn't showing leadership, and he evaluated them in front of those guys. And three times he said, "Do you love me more than these?" And the other six were glad they weren't being asked that question.
Okay. In that restoration, because that's the restoration that you're talking about there. Right?
Yeah, he was bringing him around. He expected certain things from him, which he was not then doing. And they all recognized it. It was a tough meaning.
So in that restoration, was Christ this blunt confrontation? Or was it getting him to think about his love for Christ and his love for people, right? And in this restoration is that he interacts with Peter where he is trying to set Peter up to move forward from what?
His failure.
From his failure, right? I mean, can you imagine? Guys, just imagine being Peter. I mean, you're like following Christ. You got to watch him do all these miracles. And then you deny him three times. And can you imagine standing in the courtyard? And Christ looks across at you and gives you that knowing eye. And all your failure comes down upon you. Wow. And when we look at how Christ interacted with Peter in this setting, is that he is restoring him and letting him know, Peter, you're still my servant. There's a job for you to do that you need to feed my sheep. You need to move forward in being able to do that restoration. Yes, sir.
Well, follow up right after that, he says, I haven't made a mistake in choosing you. When you are old, you will be there. They're going to crucify you. They came after me like that. You're going to be the man that I envisioned, and so forth. And then all Peter heard was, what, I'm going to be crucified? What about John?
Yeah, we definitely see Peter. We see Peter stick his foot in his mouth other times. Remember, how does Christ respond to him at other times?
Get behind me, Satan.
Get behind me, Satan, right? Get behind me. And he's like, okay, calling him Satan. Is that there's this direct confrontation of like, okay, sometimes, I don't know, I'm like somewhere in between the expressive, not expressive. I'm like more expressive in front of people, and then I kind of not when I'm by myself. But I sometimes need that straightforwardness, you know. It's like just like smack me in the face with it so that I know what you're saying. We have to remind our wives sometimes, like, hey, man, we're kind of stupid. Just tell us straight, right? Just give it to me. Okay, what's another example?
I think it was amazing that Peter, you know, thinking about all his failures, and Christ actually called for him by name and said, go get Peter.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah. It's really interesting. The book of Mark, commentators, it seems to be that Mark is written as really like Peter's sermons, a testimony of what Peter is saying. And when you get to the end of Mark and it's dealing with Peter's failures and then the tomb, there's some really sweet points in there in God's working with Peter. Okay, let's give another person that Christ works with, the Pharisees. How does Christ work with the Pharisees?
No mercy.
No mercy.
But actually,
we understand what you're saying.
But I mean, you say no mercy, but actually the parables, in one way, were mercy, so they would give you mercy.
Yeah. Yeah, it really was this, when he rebukes them, How does he rebuke them? It's in Matthew 23, verse 13, the following verses. It's the series of what? Woe to you. And this woe to you is not like, when we think of the word woe, we're like, oh, woe is me. No, woe in that idea, that context, it was a very harsh statement of confrontation. And there's these series of woe to you and calling them hypocrites and dealing with the issue that's there, right? There's this very direct confrontation. So when we look at these examples, okay, what do we begin to see determines Christ's response? Okay, so we have the person, and then what else do we have? Okay.
I mean, Peter got a lot of different sculptures. He's never a different person. He just had a different attitude at different times.
Okay, good. The attitude, okay. And so we have the person, the attitude. What else? What else would you say?
Knowledge of truth.
Okay. The knowledge. What else?
Where they are in their
faith.
Yeah.
Okay.
Milk or meat. Yeah.
What was that?
Milk or meat, where they're at, you know.
Yeah.
Where they needed the meat or the milk.
Okay, good. When we look at it, it's dealing with the person, and then it's identifying, so what circumstance or setting is this person in? It is this broad idea of this circumstance or the setting about what this is dealing with, and that these two things of the setting, the circumstance, and then the person of where they are, what's going on in their life, that these two things were impacting the way that Christ responds. Now, this isn't like, whoa, never, you know, type of thought, but when you start breaking it down that way in how we lead, okay, we look in the example of God with the Israelites. Well, God, in his working with the Israelites, there were at times where there is this close relationship, but then there's other times where God is saying to the Israelites, you're basically committing adultery. You've left me. And that there is these statements of judgment. When you read the book of Judges, what is the cycle? They sin, God judges, they repent, God brings deliverance, they follow after God. They forget God, they sin, God judges, and there is this slide based upon where they are and what is going on in their life. And so when we look at the examples of Scripture, we see this example of how God interacts with people that is not a cookie-cutter thing. And then when we look at our life, it is easy for us to get caught in our personality and our style of leadership. And then when people don't respond well to it, our tendency is to blame who?
Them,
right? They just need to deal with it. This is who I am. They're not getting this. And we have a tendency to blame them when we should be blaming who? We should be blaming ourselves in this leadership. God has called us to live with understanding with the people that we lead.
Yes, sir.
What does it say in 1 Peter about the husband and his wife, that he needs to dwell with her according to knowledge, so that what? His prayers aren't hindered. This is kind of a scary thing. You don't go through the work of getting to know your wife, guess what? It impacts your spiritual walk. It impacts your spiritual life. God wants us to lead people with wisdom. When you look at the book of Proverbs, and as you track in the book of Proverbs of how you are supposed to respond to the different categories, Proverbs kind of lays out the different categories of people, right? You have, what are your categories of people in Proverbs? You got your fools. You got your wise. You have your scorner. And then the fourth one is your simpleton, your simple person. And when you read the book of Proverbs, your response to each of these people is different. Your confrontation of a scorner is different. In fact, at some points he says, don't rebuke a scorner, because why? He's not going to listen to anything that you talk about. Another passage is going to say that when you rebuke or you bring punishment or judgment upon the scorner, why do we need to do that? Because the simpleton is watching. And the simple person is going to learn that this is a bad way to go. And so therefore, it's not that we say, okay, how do you deal with scorners? Yes, it's a different confrontation. If somebody is scorning, am I going to change them? I'm not going to change them. My confrontation is completely different. Does it mean that there is no confrontation or direction towards righteousness? No, I still direct towards righteousness, because that's going to impact other people. It's like there's a scary thing, right, Pastor Kidd, about failure in the pastorate? Because what does Timothy say? That when I fail as a pastor, that I should be rebuked before all, that all may fear. That they be saved. That there is a confrontation there, that because of where I am, that why? Because it's a warning to everybody else. When you continue to look in the book of Proverbs, the wise person, you teach. You give them understanding. They're going to listen. The simple person is that you teach and you direct and you correct to try to keep them from following after. That simple person is somebody who could, in their simplicity, they could follow after the scorner, they could follow after the wise person. They're in that place where they're just kind of a follower. And so even in the book of Proverbs, as it lays out the different categories of the different people there, we're taught to deal with them in different manners. So what I want to do now is I want to lay out for you a practical way that you can do this in your own life. Okay? So we've laid down this theological example. Okay? Now, let's be careful in our study of Scripture. We have looked at examples of this, but nowhere in Scripture do you see, thus saith the Lord thy God, thou shalt have situational leadership in your life. Okay? We're learning by example. We're learning by how Scripture gives us these examples of these things, and it illustrates a practical way of how we can go forth and lead. The Bible does command us that we need to lead with integrity. The Bible does command us that we need to lead with humility. That there's all of these things, that there are many biblical principles that God directly addresses that we as leaders, that we as men, that we as people need to lead with. Okay? So let's just make sure that we don't get messed up in our understanding in Scripture of what we're doing. So we see the example of it, and now let's lay out some very practical things here. Okay? What I'm going to share with you the core of it is from a book called Situational Leadership by the guy's last name is Hersey, and it's used in a lot of military training, and you'll see it across studies on leadership just all over the place. So if you were to Google situational leadership, all kinds of stuff will pop up on it. And it's interesting, when you do studies on leadership and you read a bunch of books on leadership, even from the corporate world, how often the world kind of stumbles upon biblical principles, that now it's even like it's a good thing that leaders serve other people corporately. And it's like, yeah, I think Christ kind of taught that a long time ago, right? And so in this, it has a framework of using some of those principles from him, okay? But when we look at dealing with it, we're looking at the where the person is, okay? And we're going to, when we lead people, we want to look at basically two aspects of where this person is, okay? We're going to look at, one, what is their skill, and two, what is their motivation, okay? So what is their skill, and what is their motivation? Now, as we look at this, we're going to understand that the concept of this is that I have to adapt my how based upon the who. How I lead changes based upon the person that I'm leading and the circumstance that that person is in. So when we have a person who has low skill and low motivation, okay? This is a person, they don't know how to do it, and they could care less about doing it. It's always an interesting thing about teaching kids about cleaning their room. You have some kids who, when you're teaching them, and when they're just toddlers, or they're, three and four, and you're teaching them to clean their room, that they could care less if their room is a bomb, and they have no skill in it whatsoever, okay? And then every now and then, though, you get someone like my daughter, who she has inherited some of her mother's orderliness. And, like, you could tell my daughter, go clean your room. Yay! That was not me growing up. And she puts everything in a line, and then it's color-coordinated at four! Right? So there's a different motivation. But a person who has low skill and low motivations, they don't know how to do it, and they really have no motivation to do it. Okay? The next category is a person who has low skill but high motivation. This is where the person, they don't know how to do it, but they really have a desire to learn. Often, this is a person at a new job, okay? First week on the job, that newbie starts, they're like, "Ah, I'm so excited," and they want to learn, and they want to grow, and they're like learning all the details, and sometimes the guys who have been there for a while are like, "Dude, calm down and stop trying to do everything, you just got to," but there's this excitement, there's this motivation to do the job well, but they're kind of clueless about what they're doing. They have this low skill, they don't have the ability. The next one then, if you can guess, is a person who has high skill, but low motivation. They've got the skills. They've been working there for 20 years. They could care less whether they do it or not, though, right? It's the extreme, is that there's not a motivation to do that thing. And so this person, they have all the ability, but they don't have the motivation or the character of what they're needing in order to do it. The bottom one is in the person who has high skill and they have high motivation. That they have the ability and they have the desire to go out and do it. Now, when you think about leadership, is that and you're leading a group of people, I heard all the time is that what do you need to do in order to lead people? You need to delegate, right? You need to delegate. You gotta delegate responsibility to people and that you got to delegate. And so in my early years of ministry, I was like delegating this over here and delegating this over here and delegating this over. Okay, I'm supposed to delegate. It's that whole idea that involvement breeds ownership, So if they're involved in it, then they're going to own it. And so I'm just delegating all of this stuff. And I began to realize is that, well, this person is falling over here. This is, I delegated it. Why isn't it done? And they're not getting this done over here. And now that's frustrating. Well, now that's impacting this over here. And it was like, I'm failing as a leader. I mean, all my response, but I delegated. When we look at these different areas, we have to treat each person differently. So the person who has low skill and low motivation, what do we do with that person? Is with that person, we're telling them what to do. Okay? They don't have the motivation, and they don't have the skill, and it's like, okay, here's the procedure. Here's number one. No, you're starting with number three. Here's number one. Do number one first. Do number two next. Do number three next. And I have to tell that person what to do. Right? There's not a lot of movement. It's just, okay, this is what has to be done. The person who has low skill but high motivation, what do you think we need to do with that person? Yeah, we've got to teach that person. Because they have the desire and they have the motivation, but they don't know what they're doing. So now I've got to teach that person what they need to do. I've got to help them to understand, here's the process. Okay, you do this, and then you do this. And I'm teaching that person to bring their skill level up. The person then that has a high skill and low motivation, what do you think we have to do with that person? We have to encourage them. I'm going to use this word, is that we have to sell them on it. Or it's the idea of coaching. When you think about a coach in at the NFL or the NBA level, are they primarily teaching skill, or are they primarily bringing a team together and the motivation? They're definitely teaching skill. I'm sure that that's happening. But a good coach is going to be able to come alongside, hey, here's the purpose, here's the reason. It's understanding the reason why behind what we're doing. This is when it's really important that you understand the philosophy behind the why you're doing what you're doing. If you don't know why you're doing what you're doing, you will never be able to teach why you're doing what you're doing. And this applies to leadership in an organization. If you don't know the why behind you have the processes, then you're not going to be able to get people to buy into it. Because they're going to have a different idea of what should be done, and they're going to have their reasons. And so you've got to teach that why in order for them to buy in that this is the process that we have to do. It's the same thing in value transference with our children, right? We have a tendency, here are the rules of our house. Brocks do this. Brocks don't do that. And we just teach the what without teaching the why. And then we wonder why our kids don't adopt our values. So I have to teach, I have to sell them on it of what is the why behind the what. What is the reason? What is the purpose in this? When you then get to a high skill and high motivation, what do you do with that person? This is a person that you delegate to. Okay, so remember my study that I did on myself? I had three. You had the motivation and the skill. You know why I only had three in there? It's because I was working with a bunch of college students who hadn't done a lot of ministry yet. And so a lot of them fit into this right here, where they had the motivation that, oh yeah, Pastor David, let's go over to Arizona State and let's witness, let's do this, let's run this amazing activity. This is going to be so much great. Hey, let's do this, reach out, let's do this in the ministry of our college group at the church. But then I went, yeah, let's do that. Why don't you run that event? Smash, fail, you know, and I'm like running behind the scenes trying to fix all the problems in the last couple of minutes before, or, you know, picking up all the stuff to tell, well, what did I fail to do? I failed to be a good teacher. So in this process, you have to identify what is the skill and what is the motivation. And then I adapt, I change my leadership based upon where that person is. My leadership is not determined upon what is natural for me. It is based upon what is effective in leading that person. We have to be willing to change. You guys can probably notice, even how by how I speak, that I'm kind of an intense person, kind of a direct person. It's like I've never been accused of beating around the bushes. It's like, bushes, are there bushes? Well, oh, I just, you know, run right through them. And because of that, in my personality, is that I have a tendency, I would love to teach like right here and just like right in. Some of you are like, whoa, back off, man. And so when I would counsel people or people would come into my office, they were first a little bit nervous to come into my office because of how intense I was as a college pastor. And I would be like this and I'd be teaching. And I had to actually go, okay, David, sit back. Cross your legs, David. Fold your arms. Just relax. Because I was communicating this like intensity when they were just wanting to talk to me about their day. Luke is here with us today from some of my earlier years of ministry. So Luke is probably going, oh yeah, I remember some of those times of when you were like that. And that I had to change. At the end of my first year, I was like, hey, I'll be a success as a pastor if like they at least like me. Like, I barely made it in with two or three. I got to the end of the year and like my college group was like, yeah, we're just kind of putting up with this guy. Because I was like radically different than everybody else. And I could either say, well, these college kids just need to grow up. They need to change. I mean, here's truth. They're not doing it. So let's deal. No. God put this class that I took at such an important time of my life to help me realize, David, you have to change. But here's the kicker. As soon as you think you got somebody figured out, guess what changes? Or the circumstances change. So now I go in to a different circumstance in a different job. Okay? Think about where you've worked. Do you have jobs you like and jobs you don't like at where you work? Right? So you can probably put yourself on this scale with different areas of work at your workplace. You're like, yeah, low skill, low to no motivation, and I have no desire. I avoid learning anything about that area, so nobody asks me about it. You're like, low skill, low motivation, and your boss is coming to you, and you know they're needing a person, and you're like, oh, I got to go. You know, you're avoiding that discussion just in case he might be telling you, this is what you're going to have to do, right? And then other areas, you're like, man, I wish they would just teach that to me. I believe I've got the skills, or I want to learn the skills, and I wish they would just teach it. And we can find, even within our job areas, where we find ourselves on this. This is the challenge of leadership, is that you're always adapting to the person and to the circumstance of how I should respond and how I should lead this person. That means, men, we never have the opportunity to be lazy in our leadership. Okay? Now, this is what amazes me, is we get a concept like this, and we go to work, and we're like, we're putting it into play at work, and we're leading like crazy. And then we walk into the door of our home. Our doors aren't metal detectors. You know what they are? For us men, the doors of our home, I'm convinced of this. I don't know how the technology works. But they're passivity infusers. It's like we walk into the door of our house, and it's like we become passive in our leadership. And we are not purposeful. I don't like talking about this because even as I'm standing here talking to you about this, I'm like, oh, yeah, I got to go home and change what I'm doing with this. And if we were to take this truth, this principle, and apply it to how we lead at home. Okay? So it's chore time. Well, you have a 12-year-old that you have been given a responsibility to go do something that you think is really straightforward. Like, go sweep out the garage. You walk in there, and you can see brush marks of the broom, and you can see that they've made effort. You need to do an evaluation, right? Is this because they don't have the skill? You're like, it's sweeping out the garage. Let me tell you, my dad taught me how to sweep out a garage. You know, we had a garage that didn't have drywall. It was still the studs. So, like, sweeping out the garage meant that everything in between the 2x4s in the wall got swept out, too. It was a thorough, complete, that means you moved this and swept underneath it. And there was this process of teaching of what that looked like, right? And what happens is that we assume that our children are over here sometimes way too often. Yeah, this is what we should be able to do. When in actuality, we still need to be teaching, or we need to be telling them the why. So men, as your kids get older, your involvement in their life is very important. Okay? In the early years of our kids' life, mom is like, she's the one that solves all of our kids' problems of and going through some of those early years, and she's doing lots of teaching. Every now and then I'm like, well, where did my daughter, man, my wife is on it. Wow, how did she learn that? And our wives have this huge impact upon those early years. But as our kids begin to get older and they begin to ask the questions and they begin to need to be coached, taught why, the reason behind it, that we've got to come alongside of them and do that. And what are the implications? So, okay, son, you haven't done your work here. So if this is going to be how you do life, what are the implications? Let's imagine that you did your work when you get your first job and you did a job at the same level at which you cleaned your room. What do you think is going to happen to you at your workplace if you keep doing it at that level? Well, what are you teaching them? You're teaching them the value of having a work ethic so that when they get into a regular job, that there's a reason behind what they're doing. It's teaching them the biblical principles. Okay? So my son got a senior in high school and a kindergartner. Okay? My poor wife, everything's the last of and everything the first of, you know? So she's like, oh, this is it! Oh, this is so, you know, so it's this struggle, and he keeps us up late, and she gets us up early in the morning in that. It's probably one of the hardest things. I'm like, oh, man, go to bed late, and then she's up. It doesn't matter what time we go to bed. She is still up. And we as men, as dads, we need to be very purposeful in taking the time to do this with our children. The parenting time and the investment that it takes from you when your kids are late elementary and teens is huge. So one of the things I'm doing this year is because I'm needing to do a lot of this as Elijah's getting ready to go off to college. So we're planning some father-son trips. And some of them, my wife is like, oh man, I wish I was going on that. I would love to be able to do that. But we're like, no, this is, why are we going on these trips? Well, my son knows why. Yeah, we're going to have fun going to the shooting competition, but he knows that I want to go on the trip because I got him in the truck for 5 hours on the way and 5 hours on the way back. And we're going to talk. And we're going to get real. And we're going to talk about stuff and biblical principles and why this and why. And so we have to be very purposeful in this. I would encourage you, okay? I would encourage you to think about the people that you lead. And make a list of the people that you lead. I'm going to encourage you to do what I did. Make a people, so your family is probably in that, and then you're probably going to have some people at work, and then you may even have some people at church that you're working with, that you're leading. And sometimes leadership is about position in terms of, okay, I'm the manager and you're the employee. But sometimes leadership is about not because I am leading from a position of, or leading from a place of position, but I am leading from a place of relationship, where I am leading in this person's life, not because I've been told this is what you have to do, but it's because I have this relationship. So there may be a guy in that's with you on this trip that you're like, you know, I'm going to put this guy's name down on here because I'm proactively working at impacting his life. And so there's this leadership of position, but then there's this leadership by relationship. And so make a list of those people and write down how you're leading them. And then write down where is their skill and their motivation. And then how should you be leading them, and see if those match up or not. And then if you want to get even deeper, is you take some of those key people, probably some of your kids again, and then the people that you work with tightly in those leadership positions, and you say, okay, based upon what circumstance, how am I leading this person? And really do an evaluation of, are you trying to lead everybody the same way? Are you forcing this, the same thing? Or are you willing to be adaptive? This is really hard in the home sometimes, though, because are all the kids at the same spot? They're not, right? But what do kids want you to do? Yeah. That you throw out that fair word. You have to treat us all the same. Are you going to treat your children all the same? No. Well, why not?
Because they're all different.
Yeah, they're not all the same. Mm-hmm. They're different. So therefore, I'm going to change in how I deal with it. Did Christ do that? Think about how he worked with the disciples. Did he work with them all the same way? Did he have closer relationships with some than with others? He did, right? Yeah. And you have that inner circle. You have his close friendship with John, then the inner circle of the three, and then the 12, and then the 70, or the 72, and then was it the 500 or 400 that he sent out? That even with the, we think of the 12 disciples were the only ones that traveled with him from place to place. But there is a group. There were a number of ladies who were traveling with that group that were preparing stuff. Imagine all the food that had to be prepared. I mean, it's not like they were bringing around their U-Haul with their freezer full of meat that they were able to go. I mean, imagine as they're traveling for sometimes months at a time, all of the work that, and we see that Christ developed different relationships with different people. Don't be afraid of the accusation that you're not fair. It's hard, but be willing to invest in people at where they are. At the same time, don't use it as an excuse to just ignore somebody that you really don't like. Like, oh, I'm just, no, you still need to lead with love and you need to lead correctly. But as you do this, it is amazing how it impacts. And so now when somebody fails to do something, I have to ask myself, okay, wait a second, where are they? Where are they? Low skill, low motivation. High motivation, low skill. Did they not understand something? And then I change my response based upon where that person is. If we do this adaptive leadership, God will really use it in our homes, in our churches, in our places of work. And this basic little principle can really impact how you lead. But what this takes is that this takes a proactiveness in your leadership. That means you just can't lead as you always lead, and you can't just lead in a way that comes to you first. That you've got to stop and think, you've got to analyze, and then you've got to move forward. Sometimes the convicting thing about leading this way is that we begin to realize how much the people that we are leading, their failure is because of our failure. That we didn't teach well in the process, or we didn't explain well in the process. And so we've got to be willing to continue to learn, to continue to grow in this process. Any questions or comments about this as we do, or what it looks like practically, or how it functions?
What was the name of the author of that book?
Hersey, H-E-A-R-S-E-Y, I believe. Unfortunately, it's not a cheap book. It's like a little short book, and it's like $35. I should have brought it with me. He gets into all the different dynamics. I mean, his flow charts are kind of all, he's got some pretty cool charts on it and stuff. What is our goal to be able to help people to do? We want to get them to where they're here, right? So though a person may start here, we're going to teach them and hopefully get them to this place where we can delegate to. And then we, in our own life, when we're the person being categorized here, okay, is that we want to be a person that can be delegated to. So that means I may have to ask questions on the why, and I need to go ask good questions on the why, and then the what, in order to be able to know what needs to be done in this process, so that my boss can delegate to me, so that I can gain responsibility in that process. Even if I don't, if I'm given a job and I really don't like the job, I've got to be careful that I don't let my dislike of the job keep me from still doing what is biblical and getting the job done. And I may just need to learn the why behind it. You know, most of us don't like cleaning bathrooms. You know, every now and then there's some people, oh, I just love cleaning. But probably most of us, cleaning bathrooms not on our high priority list. Can you imagine your church Sunday morning? No clean bathrooms. How do you think your visitors are going to respond? Yes. Dirty nursery, dirty bathrooms. Great way to tell people, please don't come back. You know what that means? Is that every time you walk in the bathroom as a member of your church, you're like, oh, there's a little bit of a mess. Hey, let me clean that up. Why? Well, because my motivation now is not because, woohoo, I love clean, but woohoo, the gospel is going forth, and I don't want to be anything that could be a distraction from going forth. So I'm gonna make sure the paper towels are being replaced. I'm going to make sure that the trash can's not overflowing, and when there's water all over the counter, I'm going to take an extra 30 seconds to get some paper towels and clean it up, not because I'm paid to do it, but because my motivation is the gospel of Jesus Christ. So you see how when we understand the why behind the what, it can change some of our attitudes in understanding what's going on there. Good. Any other questions, comments? Yes, sir.
Okay. I think you left something off the chart.
Yeah.
You have somebody that has general skills, regular skills, motivation. But all of a sudden, they're working, and they've lost their motivation. And you see that in churches a lot of times. People are there for a while, are working great, and then they drift away, and they're not there. I found that out when I was working in production, and you had to get people done. But how do you re-motivate someone? And that seems to be tough.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice that if you got somebody to go through this process where now they're like living right here, wouldn't it be nice if they always lived right there? Yeah, it would be nice if we expected the consistency of everybody else, of ourselves, of what we expect of it. And they do come back here, and so they still have the skill, but they don't have the desire. I think that this is part of the process of us being a leader who is not just saying, I'm going to lead always the same, but I'm going to look at where my people are and their skills and their motivation and where are they. Because there's all kinds of things of what can create a lack of motivation. Right? Sometimes what creates a lack of motivation has nothing to do with what's going on at work. But their family is falling apart. They come to work, and as they are leaving the house, it was kind of like World War III, as they were leaving the house, and they get to work, and there's this distraction, and they know that they're going back into the situation, or maybe there's a health issue that is going on in one of their kids, and now that's a whole lot more important than whatever you're yelling and screaming at me at work, and now I don't care. And so what you have to do to help restore that is you have to stop and ask the question of the why have they lost the motivation? What is going on in their life? And how do you figure that out, guys? Yeah, you got to listen. And for some of you, you're really good listeners. I've got some friends that it just amazes me. I watch them, and everybody comes talk to them. You know, like, it's just like they just ooze empathy and listening, and they're natural. Others of us, that's not what we're good at, but guess what we have to do? We have to become good at listening. Listening is a skill and an art. It's something that I can learn. And in order to figure out what is demotivating somebody, I have to build a relationship with them in order to hear what is a real thing that is going on in their life. Often what somebody says is not what really is going on, and that you've got to take time to be able to listen to it. So that's sometimes not a one conversation. It's sometimes a multiple conversation. So it may be in a work environment that you have somebody who is they're just falling down at work, where you're purposely creating opportunities to be able to just sit and listen. That you're going to manage not by sitting in your office, but by going and sitting down in their cubicle, or by saying, hey, if it's another guy, go do lunch, or to take time to figure out and just stop and listen to what's going on in their life. Once you figure out what is creating it, now I can help them to deal with that. And is it an issue of priority? Sometimes, is it okay to lose motivation about a job? Yeah. Okay. You know how guys like video games, especially this generation coming up? I was in the generation where it was like, okay, Mario Brothers. And but now there's all kinds of different video games, right? Is that and I tell my son, don't become an expert at something that has no eternal value. And so, do we play video games together? Yeah, I do. He kicks me consistently whenever I play with him, because we're hanging out, we're having fun together. But at the same time, do I want him to lose some motivation about playing video games? Yeah. Why? It just so happens college classes are a little bit more important than whether I have this right camo on my gun that I've got to play this many times in order to get, right? So sometimes a person's, even something that has value and is a good thing to be motivated about, changes because there's something that has become a higher priority in their life. So when my wife went into the hospital, my first wife, guess what? I was a pastor, but my work responsibilities, did they have as high as a priority as they did a year before when her health was doing okay? No. I determined that she wasn't going to go a night without somebody there at the hospital with her. I said, well, what? You know, I basically moved in for 3 months. And last her mom was there, I spent every night at the hospital. Well, why did I do that? Well, because I knew because of her health stuff that when the doctors come in at 6 o'clock in the morning and they start poking and prodding and giving all this information, she wasn't going to be able to process all that information in a way that she could tell me all that information so that we can make all the decisions that we needed to do. So what did I need to do? I needed to be there at 6 a.m. You know what I'm really thankful for? Is that I worked with a group of people who understood that I was still doing everything that I could at work. I was still going, we were still working hard, and we were still doing the stuff. But I had people who understood that my motivation for what before I was extremely passionate about was spending all kinds of extra time at was no longer exactly there the same. Because why? Because I had a higher motivation. So we have to be careful that some of this is issues of sin, but some of this, guess what, is not issues of sin. And that's part of this adaptive leadership or situational leadership, is that I have to understand the person in order to lead them effectively. And when I do that, then I'm able to adapt to where they are. I'm so thankful that when I went through that experience that I had a boss who really worked with me. I mean, they gave me the space to love my wife well. We had no family in the area, and they gave me the space to love my wife well. I will be forever grateful that they gave me the privilege to love my wife well. But you know what? After she passed away, and it took me a little bit to get back into the swing of work, now I didn't have any kids, didn't have a wife. Guess what came back? Yeah. Now that honey-do list that used to be a mile long, I don't care about that one. I don't care about that one. Nope, that was what she was wanting. That it's okay for me not to do that one. It got a whole lot smaller, and it gave me the freedom to be able to do things that I couldn't before. But that's this whole thing, guys. We have to change as leaders based upon where the people are that we are leading. And when we do that, we will love them well and help them grow. Let's close in a word of prayer. Lord, we're grateful to you that you have given us your grace. Lord, I pray that you would also give us discernment into our own life where we are not effective in our leadership. Lord, may we never become comfortable. Help us to love people well, to understand where they are and to seek to meet needs and to seek to lead with discernment and wisdom. Lord, help us and our children to understand when they're being simple and when they're being wise and when they're being foolish or a scorner. Help us, Lord, to follow the example of you and willing to deal with situations and people according to what is the need of the time. In your name, amen.